Honestly, just keeping it loose, man. That's what we're doing here. It's just keeping it loose. Talk about whatever the fuck we want, because this is what we do. This is what I do, you know, now is like part of what this is you know, I'm poor, so I need money. So you gotta throw a bone to the patrons.
Right.
So thank you, patrons, if you're listening to this. So we've got the one and only John Tenney here. John, thanks for coming on this
Oh no,
and
thanks for having me. Thanks for wanting to ramble with me.
yeah, just like, you know, really talking about whatever the hell we want, you know. We're on this synchronized journey right now of I don't know, just receiving confirmation about where we're at right now and what we're doing and what we're reading.
Well, before you go any further, I'm going to tell you, I think I asked you to help me with a fanzine that I'm doing this year.
Absolutely.
And when that fanzine is done, you will get copies to send to your patrons.
Oh, hell yeah. Even better.
See?
This is amazing. So see, stick with us. You're gonna get some goods here. But yeah, no, that's do you want to talk a little bit about that, or at least, you know, talk about what you're wanting to do with this? Because it is absolutely fascinating, and like, you know, that the time period that you're exploring in this is really fascinating, especially with the topic itself.
Yeah, so I'm going to be doing four fanzines this year. The first one is already done. Jessica is proofreading it and editing it right now for all of my. I barely ever proofread anything, but this I'm going to proofread just because I know that sometimes people can't handle the way that I write is the way that I speak. So there's a lot of commas and pauses and parentheticals, and that doesn't work for a lot of people. But the second fanzine that you're going to help me with is witness sketches of flying saucers from a time period in the 60s.
Which, you know, this is the time period where it's becoming more acceptable to publish kind of humanoid stories and like your more of your popular journals at the time. And like the last episode that I did of the main show, we dove into that. We dove into the humanoids, the flying saucer review special issue that kind of really, I think it was like the first publication that really put a history out there and said, well, you know, this has been going on for a long time, but nobody really wanted to talk about it because you know, the subject was so ridiculed. And then 1965 comes along and everything changes, because I mean, 65 to 67, you know, it's this worldwide flap of like UFOs, humanoids, all that kind of stuff. And it's just a fascinating time period for sightings of weird humanoids, aliens, and all sorts of different stuff. So I'm excited to work on this, because it's going to be
It's
great.
interesting that you say that, because the reason I picked like 65 to 70 is because it did seem to become popular for newspapers, especially to start printing witness sketches of UFOs. And I feel like the acceptance of seeing these kind of crudely drawn interpretations of what people thought they saw leads to people being able to discuss and draw humanoids.
Absolutely.
Like, once people got over the fear of this image looks ridiculous, this thing that you've drawn looks ridiculous, once that became accepted, so 70 hits, and then like you're on your way. Like, now you've got people drawing, you know, little robotic creatures and gnomes driving cars, and they're like, we're just going to put this in the newspaper. It's fine. Like, people didn't balk at the terrible flying disc, you know, with two giant humps on the top that look like breasts. So let's just do gnomes in cars now.
Yeah, exactly. And like one of the things that I've always enjoyed with Welcome UFO people is that like most of the time I'll give Todd something that does have sketches that go along with it, but every now and then, especially with this weekly Bender series that we're doing, I'm like, most of this stuff doesn't have sketches because it's like newspaper accounts in 1947. And we just released for this week like one of my favorite stories, which is, you take the story however you want, but like in a Tacoma newspaper, there was a story that this UFO landed on the roof of this one house, and there were these three aliens that got out, and the press showed up, and they just got back in their UFO and took off. And it's just like nobody's ever illustrated that before, and putting that into a creative medium, just like I get so much joy out of that because one, you're introducing people to like a story that they'd never heard before, and there are other stories in 1947 that don't really get talked about. There was the Bill Schuening story from it was like the day that Kenneth Arnold saw the saucers that he claimed to have a humanoid sighting in his own field. He was a farmer, and just like looked out, saw a couple of figures in his field just doing some random stuff, looking at soil, and then getting back in their UFO. But it's like, I don't know, there's something charming about those stories, but like at the same time, you have to wonder how. And you never get really the answer to this. How does this affect somebody? How does that
Yeah.
change somebody? I think about that all the time.
I love that people see these fantastical, crazy creatures, usually doing something that seems really mundane. Like they are just out there doing their thing. They're just checking their soil samples, or, they're just checking out the outside of their craft, whatever. Like they're doing something. But you see this fantastical creature in front of you, and then. Like you tell a couple people about it, maybe, and then maybe it gets written up in a journal, but then you just go on living your life.
Like I and that's the thing is like if you've experienced all this weird stuff, it almost doesn't even it factors it seems like it factors in maybe more subconsciously than anything, and maybe you'll think about it every now and then, but it's just like where does that go, and how do you go to your 9 to 5? And I'm like, I'm one of those people that have seen weird shit
Yeah,
on the way
me
to
too.
work.
Yeah.
And it's just like, I gotta go to work now. What
Yeah,
the hell?
I've told Jessica, I've told people, including Jessica, but I've told people for years and years, like I, over the past 33 years of doing this and the stuff that I've experienced, I am closer and closer to being like a person that stands outside and screams at people that there's weird stuff going on. And everybody just knows that I'm moments away from that. Like at any significant portion of the day, there's a part of my brain that will perhaps start to realize the things I have seen and experienced, and that little tiny web will just snap, and then forget it. I'm gone. But am I really gone, or am I just, when people used to have religious experiences, pre 20th century. Like that was it. Their life from that point forward was talking about that religious experience that they had. Like now, whether it's the psychology and the sociology of like learning to exist within a society, so we've just buried it down and convinced ourselves that it's weird, but I have to go on in reality and I can't be that person that stands outside and screams at people. But there's something in you that I feel like most people, most experiencers and most people who've seen weird stuff, I feel like it's a very tenuous thread that holds us and grounds us to being able to go to a 9 to 5.
And the majority of people aren't, going out making money off their story or anything like that. They're just normal average people that just they and somebody's always got that story, and you're in town, you'll hear, oh yeah, he's got a story about that, or story that seen this one time and everything like that. But it's like, that's all it ever ends up being, is like that story. And I always find that interesting to, when you juxtapose it to kind of like the contactees. A lot of those people just went out and tried to make money off the story, like so many of them did.
But I'll tell you, it's a slippery slope for me. Like when I'm trying to evaluate a person's experiences, I can only go obviously by what they're telling me and what they're showing me and who they seem to be. And there's again a fine line when I'm talking to someone and they are, I mean, it's just they're having paranormal, supernatural, ufological experiences daily, constantly. They're constantly seeing a ghost. They're constantly getting haunted objects. They're constantly like experiencing EVPs and seeing apparitions. And they are completely well adjusted. There's a part of my brain that goes, oh, so it's all fake.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
Like there's that aspect of it, but then there's another aspect of it where it's like, oh, they're constantly seeing ghosts, they're constantly getting haunted objects, they're constantly having magical and ufological experiences, and the way they're timing it, they're insane.
That's the spectrum right there. And it's like, and when I put myself in those terms, I'm like, I'm one of those people. Okay.
And I'm floating between those two sides of the coin. Like I know when I talk about eating at a diner that doesn't exist, I sound insane. But also, like I'm seem to be a relatively well adjusted, well liked person, so maybe it's bullshit because how can I have eaten at a place that doesn't exist and carry on with a normal life?
How do you hold those two together? And like, I'm gonna think about that for rest of my life now. It's like,
It's a
how do
very
you,
thin thread of sanity.
it really is like, I don't know, you look into this shit and you don't even need to look into this shit, and it just fucks with your life, there is definitely that attitude of certain people who are like, I don't want to experience anything. It'll ruin my life.
And then, like, you look at some people who I feel do fall over the edge. And I talk about this a lot in my lectures, like people who, oh, I'm going to follow this through to any and all ends. And like, I have told people repeatedly for, I don't know, 20 years when I started to really kind of deep think this stuff, like that's an edge that you might not want to walk to because a lot of people have fallen over it and not come back. You know, if you look at, like I talk about Bender a lot, about Albert Bender a lot, right? Like he goes from having these weird experiences and the Men in Black and whatever, whatever, to like if you listen to Bender's last lectures, if you read like his last writings, he's talking about how like there's an evil spirit in him that mentally causes him to create havoc in other people's lives. And you know, he thought badly about a person, so their car went off the road and they bled to death. And there's like, oh man, like you went over the edge.
He did. And the weird thing is like he also came out of it all right, 'cause he seemingly lived a normal life after
Like, how do
that.
you go from thinking that your thoughts kill people to, okay, now I'm going to sell televisions for the next 20 years?
Exactly. It like the thing is like it's really easy to kind of feed your delusion if you let it. If you let it do that, depending upon what your poison is, whether you get hooked on doing like EVP stuff every day, that could become a thing where it does feed a delusion. Tarot cards, it could feed your delusion. Like a lot of things can do that in this circle, because it's this tool of knowing, or perceived knowing, that You think it can give you an answer to a question that is not answerable any other way. So, you end up feeding that delusion. And I think, for most people at a certain point, they're just like, okay, I need to stop doing this. I've definitely been there with certain things. It's just like, oh, this is in my life now. And, there are definitely certain experiences that kind of brought that on that I've had, but yeah, it's easy to feed your delusion.
Yeah, there's a it doesn't get talked about much, and I was actually thinking about writing something about this, but in older occult circles, when I first started meeting witches and occultists in the mid 80s to early 90s, like everybody now, like there's this whole everybody knows what manifestation is when you talk about magic and the occult, like you can manifest stuff. But in the mid to late 80s and early 90s, there was talk in occult circles about manifectation, not manifestation, manifectation. And that was that your magical practice, your magical thinking could become infected. And instead of being this positive thing, turned into this kind of horrible negative thing. And I don't see people talk about it or write about it at all anywhere. But even to the point of like, if you're reading a lot of books on how to do magic or you're following a certain magic practitioner, that your magic and your magical systems become infected with theirs. And then you're no longer doing magic for yourself. You're
You're
actually
doing it for
just
somebody else.
You're doing it for someone else, and their magic is getting more powerful. And they're saying, oh, look, it works for me all the time. And you're like, well, it doesn't work that often for me. And it's like, no, because you're literally doing someone else's magic. You're literally thinking in someone else's magical way, and you've become manifested. Like your magic has become infected with someone else's magical thinking.
Yeah, exactly. And as someone who has like started to dip their toes, like after like this summer is when I started to kind of dip my toes into more occult things. I started to, pick up tarot cards and stuff. But I also, just this past weekend, I built my first altar, because I felt compelled to do it. And so I'm building this altar to Aphrodite, and I'm thinking to myself, well, what the fuck does an altar look like? Like in your head. And I'm like, no, there's no way. And I'm like, I'm getting this kind of vision in my head of what I want it to be. And if you look at it, it kind of resembles like, that typical scene in a movie where you have like flower petals leading to a bed kind of thing. It's like fake flowers on an altar with chocolate and like lavender and rose quartz. And it's like it real that's really what it looks like. And it's like, oh yeah, that's my magic. That's how I want it to be,
My altars, I have a few in my house. They literally look like thrift store tables. Like if you look at my practicing the altar that I use the most often, like it has pennies and pencils and like weird pieces of grass and acorns, and there's no rhyme or reason to it whatsoever. It's solely created so that when I look at it, I'm filled with like happiness and I'm filled with like comfort and caring and kindness. But if you looked at it, you'd be like, the fuck kind of garage sale is going on?
Yeah, there's that one that you shared on TikTok that it's just like a bunch of family photos, right? Is
Yeah, that's my ancestor altar. Yeah, the one
yeah.
that has I told people to put a mirror on it because you're going to be someone's ancestor. And an ancestor doesn't have to be, physically related to you. You can be someone's ancestor through mentorship. So you're going to be someone's ancestor, which is why I always put a mirror on there. And then I put a blank frame for all of the people in my family that I'll never know, all those who don't have a name and will never have a name. But the really important part for me on my ancestor altar is I have pictures of some pretty ter I have I mean we've all had pretty terrible ancestors.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a white European descent. I've had some pretty bad people in my family, and they're on there too as a reminder that, for your good ancestors, be better, and for your bad ancestors, make up for them.
And this and that's kind of one of the things that like it seems like it pops up in like if you watch if you go down the YouTube rabbit holes of watching tarot readings and stuff like that, you'll always find those tarot readings that are like breaking these kind of ancestral bad habits and things like that. And it's like, well, yeah, that kind of makes sense that somebody could conceivably come along and like help to kind of break those kind of bad vibes and everything like that, and it just kind of change the nature going forward. But it like
Well, and hopefully those ancestors, if there is an afterlife, if there is an afterworld, hopefully, once they died, there was some reconciliation or some period of relearning where they got there and they were like, oh, fuck, I was terrible. I'm gonna help my future descendants to not be the fucking terrible person that I was when I was alive.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, well, if you definitely have guides guiding you, they definitely have to be, they're probably the ones that, probably did, there are those that did good, but there are those that fucked up. It's like, okay, well, let's fix this thing. Let's definitely change things. And I think that's when I was doing my research for my presentation for Ryan Sprague's con there, that Phenomicon. Reading Swedenborg's kind of stuff was always interesting, especially when he started talking about like aliens around Venus having died there. They're just like hanging out around the planet. And it's like, oh, well, these motherfuckers are fucking up. We should probably do something about
Right.
that. Yeah, it's just like you gotta intone for it in some way, and yeah, that's just like one way of doing it. Like it has been like, and I told you this earlier, like writing this book has been less about the aliens themselves and more about everything else outside of it. So it's just like almost like you need to be a student of more than just the thing that you're looking into. So, like going down that path for that presentation, reading about the early channelers channeling spirits from Mars and stuff, the inhabitants of Mars, and doing all of that, and how it kind of ties into the contactee stuff, which is so strange. So like the journey from like Swedenborg all the way through to like the New Age movement is very fascinating,
Yeah,
especially when
100%.
you take trips through like Gaia and Edna Bell.
Yeah, and I mean, I love that stuff too, in watching how, there's this really, it's probably 10 years span of time with the contactees. It's the contactees. I mean, we start off with Space Brothers and Venusians and stuff like that. But it really gets to a point where the contactees have just become Christian ministers by like the end of their run. Like they're back to the Bible, they're back to like angels and Jesus Christ is the Lord and Savior. And that's a really fascinating turn that it goes from this religiosity and then it's negotiated like with the new technology into aliens, but then returns to religiosity again.
Very weird with some like with Truman Bethram, it's like there from the start, and it's so very strange because it's just like, Aurah Raines is all about that Christian life, which is like utterly fascinating. Like space alien woman wearing a beret, and she's preaching about like how you should honor your husband and stuff. And I'm like, what the hell is this?
Yeah, so strange. I don't know if you saw on Twitter recently, but I posted a picture, a photograph of Aura Raines.
No, I did not. I'll have to
Yeah,
look at that.
so I found a picture. I was going through collected different photo archives of conventions at Giant Rock, and there's a dark-haired woman standing near Truman's table, and on the back of the photo, the photographer wrote, "Woman identified herself as Commander Aura Raines."
That's fascinating. I love that shit. That's amazing.
And so it's
No.
like she's not even just this thing. She's just like this good-looking South American woman who's hanging out the UFO conventions that somehow or another Truman turns into like a UFOnaut so he can talk to her.
I think if anything, and what I appreciate about his story is that it's kind of different from the other contactees. Like, yeah, he tried to make a buck off of it, but he didn't write stories about going to their planet or anything like that. He just kind of got political with it and
Yeah.
talking about the gold standard and stuff.
Yeah, for sure. I think for me, like dollar for dollar, and he was out for a lot of dollars, I really get fascinated by Dick Miller. I don't know how much you know about Dick Miller, but
Tiny bit, but not much.
he was a contactee who started off in Detroit. Saying that he had created, a shortwave radio that could contact aliens. And then pretty soon that had turned into like him channeling Mongka, MONKA. And like he turned that into like, I know that we now live in a world where people will stream for, 10 hours or 12 hours playing video games and stuff like this. But he would release these like, multi-tape audio cassettes where he was just in a trance channel state for the being Mongka,
Oh
and they
God.
were like 8 hours long, and he just
Dear
like
God.
sold them en masse to people and just wrote these books of channeled nonsense for years up until the 70s. And I was like, how, like, was he re like, that's that when I start to ask, like, is he just buying his own bullshit, or has he really experienced something that flipped his lid? Because who, like in the 1950s, was like, you know what's going to really sell? 8 hour recordings of me telling people how to live their life.
Yeah, like this is a person that probably never lived long enough to know who David Icke was and how long his dumbass presentations are. But like,
Right?
yeah, exactly. Like, long form, like that takes a level of dedication that
Yeah.
I man, like,
Especially when you're selling a single like 8 hour lecture, for $1.
And I've been giving away hours of audio for free. God damn it. What the fuck am I doing?
If you would have just said that you were Monka instead of you.
Yeah, I could be beloved and hated by so many people. Would have just saved me so much time, would have earned me so much money. But it is what it is. One thing that I wanted to ask you, because I remember like years ago, you were talking about how, during the 1980s with the MJ-12 stuff, people were like trying to authenticate those kind of documents, doing typewriter samples. And I remember you saying that you were doing that yourself with your own typewriters. What's the biggest difference from like all of that stuff in the 1980s, all of this disinformation stuff that, like in that time period, living through that time period versus now, what are the big differences to you that you see?
Well, first of all, it was obviously like pre-internet, if you wanted to make some fake documents, there, it was a laborious fucking process, right? Like, it wasn't as hard to get a hold of the materials because typewriters were still in wide usage. Typewriters were built to last, and so they were around all the time. So finding the typewriters wouldn't be hard, but like getting the verbiage right, getting the letterhead to look right, getting the language to feel right, that was fucking laborious. Now, typewriters, I mean, you can go to any garage sale and find a typewriter. They're fucking everywhere. They're not expensive at all. You can look up through FOIA or through online, like you can look up countless hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of pieces of actual documents from the government and how they were written from the 1950s to the 1970s. Look at the verbiage, look at the letterhead, look at the paperwork markings at the bottom. There's Photoshop. It's 1,000 times easier now. And newly made documents are all being made on computers. So, like, everybody can make a PDF. Everybody can, like, have a free Word application. Every government document that's being created now is being created in OpenOffice or Microsoft Word. So, the ability to just retype something, is fantastically easy. Where before it took a little bit of dedication to, I got to get this right. How am I going to make this look like it was typed in the era that it was typed in? Now you just like can download old documents, strip the verbiage out, put your own in, and the document's done. There's no way to really check if it was an actual document or not.
And I think modern day grifters do not have respect for the way that they did it in the 80s, because if they did it the way they did in the 80s, they'd be taking photographs of those and sending off the film. They wouldn't be sending documents.
Yeah, for sure. 100%. And that's the other thing too, right? Like, so people always talk about, well, if someone posts like a UFO photo online, we can check the metadata, right? So I can change the metadata on stuff. Most people can. Like, you can go in and strip a photo of all of its metadata and replace it with anything you want. I can do that. I learned how to do that when I was working in advertising. Like, just go in and strip out the copyrights and replace them with our own. That's fine. But in the 80s and 90s, like, you could literally, someone would show you a UFO photograph and you could go and get the negatives. You could tell if the negative where the negatives were processed, when they were processed. You could take the physical camera apart, look for light leaks, look for blurs, take the physical camera with the same type of film back to the location, take reference photographs to see how the camera operated. Like, there was this huge wealth of stuff that you could do with an image that you can't do now.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that there are a lot of good, strange photographs from the past that I don't think, get the credit that they deserve. Like, everybody's going to talk about the McMinnville, photographs and stuff like that, but the photographs by what the hell is his name? Åke Leon from Sweden. He, captures it's like a triangular shaped craft that came out of this other bigger, rounder UFO and stuff like that. Nobody talks about those photographs. There are seemingly more convincing photographs that just don't get talked about. And that's, I don't know, that's always kind of like my biggest gripe with modern ufology is that they don't look to the past ever. It's just, it's now.
It's really amazing to me the slew of UFO people who have appeared since 2017, who say, like, I've been studying UFOs for like that now, and they can legitimately say, like, I've been studying UFOs for, the past 7 years or 8 years. And that seems like something to people who aren't in the UFO field. Like the normal person's like, oh, fuck, they spent 8 years doing this. Not realizing that there are people who have done this for 30 years or 40 years or 50 years still at this point. There are some moldy oldies around, right? It's really fascinating to me that you can be on CNN or MSNBC or Fox, or even in documentaries and television shows, and presented as an expert in the UFO field, and you have legitimately only had an interest in the UFOs since 2017 or 2018, without knowing any of the history behind any of it.
Yeah, that's like modern programming. Like, that's what it is. Take somebody, put a name on TV, have them say something, and yeah, they're experts and stuff.
Yeah, you can be teaching quantum jujitsu up until like 2015, and then all of a sudden, now you're a UFO expert.
Yeah, just there you are, self-proclaimed. And
And
yeah,
if you
you
ask them, if you ask them a question, if you were to say to, like, let's say you have a UFO hearing in Congress, as they have now had, and someone up there was like, and you know what, the like, okay, so let's say you've got some UFO bros up there and you've got me, and someone says to me like, what do you think that we should investigate with these UFO sightings? And I were to say something to the effect of like, well, one of the interesting things that I think that should be researched is the people who commute say that they're communicating with alleged extraterrestrials always have to consume something at some point in their journey. Like, and start talking about like the Mitchell sisters having to drink wine and orange juice, and Orfeo Angelucci having to drink like the green liquid. And like, that would blow fucking people's minds. Like, wait a minute, aliens are giving people stuff to drink? What the fuck is that around? They're giving stuff people to eat. What is happening here? What are you talking? We're talking about this little blob that's moving like on this FLIR camera. What are you talking about? And I'm like, I'm talking about fucking side hunched aliens in 1955 that are holding sparking rods above their head, seen by police officers. And they're like, what are you talking about? And I'm like, let's look at Springfield's drawing of Honeycutt. And you know, I don't know if you know that case. But like, there's an alien with standing with his hands above his head, holding a sparking object while they pray by the side of the road. It's like, what documentary that's being serious about UFOs is discussing that fucking shit?
Like nobody, and like I just want to say first and foremost, the sketches that Stringfield did for those, so good.
They're so
So
good.
amazing.
They are amazing.
Because it's just like, yeah, it's just there's these short people and they've got these like big
First
old,
of all,
like,
they're in his drawing, they're wearing like sweatpants.
yes, they are wearing sweatpants. They have like, it's almost like they have a tumor on them. Like they're like it's slightly distended. And yeah, there's that one that's holding his hands above its head. And yeah, it's just like such a strange thing. And it's like all of that strangeness is just missing. Like it's not there. It is, it feels like it is just like boiled down to in such a way that it has, it can't be anything other than like foreign technology. Like not even extraterrestrial. It like there's nothing that they're presenting that makes it seem like it's extraterrestrial in any way. I mean, whether you're David Grush, like, bullshitting your way through saying, we have biologics, which is like,
Right.
yeah, how can you say we have biologics when you said you couldn't even talk about it if we had UFOs? Like,
Right. And I've discussed this too, and I think like there are certain, like, whether it's working in television or stuff, like we're on the television shows I've worked on, like I've had non-disclosure agreements. I can't talk about the television show. But like my non-disclosure agreements don't say you can't discuss your non-disclosure agreement. When you're dealing with like top secret and above top secret security clearances and non-disclosure agreements with the government, those agreements and contracts actually say that you can't discuss the fact. You're allowed to say, I can't discuss it. You can't say, I have a non-disclosure agreement. Because right. saying you have a non-disclosure agreement is revealing information that can compromise your top secret security clearance, or saying yeah. like, I can't talk about it, it's top secret. That reveals that something is top secret you can't talk about. All you can say is, I can't discuss it. So the rhetoric of all of these people saying like, I can't talk about it because I have an NDA, I can't talk about it because it's top secret. No, you can't even tell us that. You're right. lying outright. Because you're already telling us that you have an NDA and you're already telling us it's top secret. So you're already lying.
Right. And why on earth would they approve you? Like, because he's the one thing that David Grush has said over and over again on the programs that he goes on is that he goes through security channels to get things cleared in order to share them. Why would the government share a downed UFO that, like, you know, you're able to share now? Like, it just seems such bullshit. Like, I did an episode for Patreon on his appearance on Joe Rogan's podcast, and, you know, it's full of that, oh, I can't talk about that, like, you know, talking vague numbers and sure. things like that. And it just didn't make sense. Like, how can you go through the government to get security clearances to talk about this or to get things cleared, talk about that, when you can't really, you're saying you can't talk about really anything? It's just yeah. baffling to me.
And when it comes to documentaries and television shows and, you know, people going on podcasts, the idea that you have, let's just take television shows, reality shows for a second. The idea that a reality show is going to show you the toppest of top secret information and reveal the startling truth about UFOs, something that no one has ever seen. Watch next Thursday, watch this documentary, because it is going to blow your mind. The fact that they think they have mind-blowing information, and the editor of the documentary or the television show, who's making like $15 an hour editing, sees this mind-blowing information and doesn't tell anybody about it, should mm-hmm. reveal to you that it's not mind-blowing information.
Yeah.
Because yeah. there are so many people involved with the production of television and documentaries, like from editors, mixers, sound mixers, cameramen, directors of photography, who don't have any skin in the game. If they were to see a fucking alien, or they were to see a fucking genuine flying saucer, that guy's going home slack jawed and telling his wife and his friends, you don't know what I just fucking worked on today. And within minutes, it's out.
Yeah.
It's not held until next Thursday.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's, you know, leaked out to like TMZ or something like that. It's just, that's the way in which, like, the internet works. Like, if a wrestler is coming back to a certain company, you're going to hear about it before it actually happens on TV. Like, that's just the way in which information flows nowadays. And like, pretending like you have some kind of secrets in the game is just like absolutely ridiculous. And like, you know, the names that are coming out now saying that, oh, well, they introduced it, because like I think it was somebody on Twitter that said it was Eric Davis that gave him all this information, which is right. you know, it's Eric Davis,
so. Right? Yes. Yeah.
And I mean, to, you know, take that for what you will. I do have his book on audiobook, and I can't wait to listen to it at some point just to see how like crazy it is. But
yeah. Or the fact that, and we've seen this happen in over the past 5 or 6 years, or the fact that one of these UFO experts presents information startling and shocking to the public consciousness that UFO researchers have known about for 20 or 30 years.
Yeah. It all recycled information, and
but since it's the first time they heard about it, you know, we see that happening all the time. Like, How many times has DeLong had to like delete a tweet or an Instagram photo because he saw for the first time a fucking Billy Meyer photograph and posts it as real, you
Which
know?
makes me think that he hasn't really been reading books for 25 years.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, just like another dude with like, something to get out of it, and I don't like the thing is like how lucrative is the UFO game at this point? I really tend to wonder about that. How lucrative can it be? I mean, I'm sure, if you, publish a book that is that sells well, like I'm sure UFO of God is probably selling decent enough that
I mean, it really has to do with, I mean, there are a lot of moving pieces, right? First of all, like, what is the person's like normal lifestyle, right? Because like for me, if I wanted to grift, like I don't have to grift that hard for it to mean something to me. I live on probably, you know, $25,000 or $30,000 a year. So for me to make an extra 10 or 15 would be a great fucking grift for me and wouldn't seem to be a great grift to anybody but me because I'd be making an extra 10 or $15,000 a year. So that's like, what's a person's lifestyle habits and how is it going to affect them? So that can be a good grift for some people. You know, Buck Nelson selling $1 books, you know, there's a newspaper account of someone who lived in the area at the time who said, it was a woman who worked at the post office. And in the newspaper article, she's asked by the reporter, "Do you know Buck?" And she says, "I do. And I know that he has those conventions. But really, I also know that every day he's here counting money out of his P.O. box." So for Buck Nelson, even making in that time $10 a day, that's a good grift for him. Right? Now you have people who have higher level positions in government. They're maybe making $100,000 a year or $150,000 a year. So what's a good grift for them? A good grift for them is forming an LLC or a business, getting some government contracts, and making a couple $100,000 a year.
Absolutely.
And that's what they do.
And it would make sense that Davy
Like,
Crush
would it be
is.
worth it for me or you? Here's the thing. Would it be worth it for me or you to spend a year creating an LLC or an incorporated business with a board of directors, spending all the money to put all the pieces in place, renting an office space, doing all that with the hopes that maybe we could make, you know, the money back that we spent forming and incorporating and creating the board of directors and all of that? Or is it more beneficial for someone like you or me or someone in our positions to just write a crazy book and make an extra $5,000 a year?
No, it's kind of low stakes at that point. So,
Yeah.
like, you got low stakes. There's more money on the table. So, and I mean, like, good on Chris Bledsoe right now. Just
I guess.
I know I'm gonna read that book at some point. Maybe listen to the audiobook, but it's just like, and like,
Let
I
me just
think
tell you
what's
something so funny about the whole Bledsoe thing.
Yeah.
So this is maybe 8 years ago. Like 8 years ago, I was doing a paranormal convention, and a woman came up to me and started talking to me about, I've got to come and visit her. She lives on the east, near the East Coast, and she got this guy who's got all these friends that are former military, and he can summon UFOs and blah 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 blah. And as she was telling me, like, she was just 100% full believer, and I was like, "Oh, this sounds super interesting to me." Like, and she's like, "I've been there, and people from the military have been there, and former military officials have been there, whatever, whatever." And I was like, "Oh, that sounds really great." About a year later, I kind of forgot about it. I still knew who she was and we were still in contact. I kind of forgot about it though. But then I started seeing, like, this is when like the Bledsoes hit really hard. And all of a sudden I was like, "Oh, that's that fucking guy." And then like I started seeing the pictures he was posting and I was like, Oh, this is garbage. Like, this is just straight up like blurry photographs of like street lights and flashlights out in the forest. Like, this is terrible. How in the world has this dude conned so many people?
Like that, I think that gets into the nature of like just how UFO like photos and footage is just shared on the internet because people just eat it up. Like this like jellyfish UFO thing, this video that's going around.
Sure.
Like
Before we get to jelly, before we get to the jellyfish, though, here's the thing, which I'm just discovering in my mind, right? Going back to how we started this conversation, Bledsoe has now turned into religiosity.
Yes. I mean, look at the cover of the book. It is,
It went.
it's,
It's the same playbook.
yeah. Yeah, it's the same old contactee playbook, which
Yeah.
it is. And like when I look at that, I look at, kind of how things morph for certain experiencers, whether you take them for face value. And when it comes to people who seem like they've had more genuine contact with something that they can't explain, there's not an embellishment that is book length. It maybe you can get an article out of it, maybe you can get like a three-part article out of it, like the Catman Batman story.
Yeah.
But beyond that, there's nothing. And like, I don't want to fully say that like anybody that tells their story isn't totally believable, but when you recycle the same narratives over and over and over again, like it just becomes easier to kind of pull it off, especially with people in this field that don't go back, don't learn their history, don't like read anything. It's just like there's Whitley Strieber's Communion and then everything else that came after it.
Yeah. This fanzine, the first fanzine that I did about this contactee, it's 28 pages long as a fanzine. I struggled to get 28 pages. Like, it's that short. And it covers everything. Like, there's almost a full reprinting of a lecture in that. Like, I had, like, I was like, I this, like, there's newspaper articles, like, it's padded because. Like 28 pages for this contactee story that spans arguably about a decade. Like in 10 years, it can be condensed down. Maybe, I mean, if I take the fluff out of this fanzine, it's maybe 13 pages of his story. So the fact that like you were talking about like Strieber's got, I don't know, a dozen fucking books out.
About that, not to mention like he also cashed in writing novels that are, inspired by that stuff. He wrote a series that briefly became a television series on Sci-Fi. So,
Yeah.
like,
Well,
it's
and
been
with art,
lucrative.
wrote the book that became The
Yes.
Day After
The Day
Tomorrow,
After
right?
Tomorrow. The coming
The
superstorm or
coming
whatever.
global superstorm.
Yeah, like such a classic. I will say the movie was better than the book. But and I mean like, it's with Art Bell, I mean, I just get a kick out of the man's belief on Ouija boards. So great. But
But you're absolutely right about like the original experiencers, whether it happened or not, their stories. I mean, if you look at those literal, sure, they were called booklets or books, but they were just like pamphlets. Like whether it is Buck Nelson only pulling off like maybe 40 pages, or like I think the Joe Simonton's booklet was like 6 pages long or
Yeah,
something like that.
and he didn't really make any money off it,
No,
so
or like Daniel Fry and Truman, like those books are stretched to get to like 100 pages.
oh dear God, reading Aboard a Flying Saucer, just like Like it's only 188 pages, but like it's on the thickest like paper that you can get,
Yeah.
and like he really had to stretch that story out to like, make it seem like it was a bigger deal. But yeah, it like there's a lot of padding, whereas like all of these stories are like, you read all of these old stories and such, and it's just like, yeah, I had this brief experience. That's it. I remember
But the
reading
thing is
the.
like, I'm sorry to interrupt, but the thing
No,
is
go ahead.
like, it's stayed brief, right? Like, I think this is what's so interesting to me is that the kind of repetitive nature of stuff that has to do with weirdness. Like, if you take the how long, if you wrote the whole story of like the pilots who saw the Tic Tac, right? Like, how long is that story? That's like a 3-page story. And
Right.
that's all they got.
Right. And then you got like Kevin Day out here with like two books about it, I think, at this point.
But this it's literally a 3-page story. And
Yeah.
that's it. That's all I've got.
Yeah. Which, so this is the tips. These are the tips that we're giving you. It can't be long, folks. It can't be too long. It just it can't. That once you start adding page length and it's bloating a little bit, that's when you're on to something else. But I think the thing that I've always found fascinating about this is like there's a history there if you look for it. There is like, certain time periods where, when you go back to the Honeycutt and stuff, like 55 was like the first year that I think there were multiple eyewitnesses reporting humanoids. Like there was like, I think there was like 7 cases that year, with Kelly Hopkinsville, the Honeycutt case. There was that one woman who I think was in Georgia that saw something. There was those
Or
kids
is
in.
it, I mean, that's the first, I mean, because you're getting whatever that book is called, what Kellyville and other incidents, something like that.
Encounter at Kelly and others of
Other incidents,
1955.
yeah. Like, is that the first time it's happening, or is that the first time it's being collected?
I think it's the first time it's being collected for sure.
Right, yeah.
And because I mean, like, that's where that history gets kind of dicey, because it's like after 1980, can you trust it? When you start going further and further back, and even if people are reporting stuff in the 1970s and they're talking about incidents in the 1940s, how trustworthy is that? I'm always going to have that threshold of 1980 when Bud Hopkins starts meddling with things, but that's just my personal preference with things, because like I don't know, when your humanoids start to get streamlined, it just seems like a pretty big issue. But like, yeah, definitely I think it comes down to how things are collected and how that history kind of like surfaces, because like even Encounter at Kelly didn't come out till like what, the 70s, I think, is when they published it. So like,
But there's also things that are involved, like there's real day-to-day. So I've been trying to track down a 55 encounter because I'm, and if anybody out there wants to help me research this up, it's fine. I'm looking for an encounter in Florida in 1955 with like a either frog man, swamp man, or Bigfoot near Jacksonville, Florida. Because if you watch, I love old, obviously old science fiction movies. If you watch Creature from the Black Lagoon, there's a extra bonus feature on the DVD where they're talking to Rico Browning, who played the Creature from the Black Lagoon swimming in the waters. And when they remade, when they did Revenge of the Creature in 1955, they were filming in Florida. Rico Browning in the suit had been filming the underwater stuff. He had to go to the bathroom. He swam under the water to get to a dock where there was a public restroom. And when he came up out of the water, there was just a woman and her daughter who were there at the park who didn't know that they were filming a movie there. And he came up out of the water. She screamed, grabbed her daughter, and they ran off before he could tell her, "We're filming a movie." And so I've wondered for years, like, is there in 55 this in, did she report that to someone? Did it get in the newspapers? And then what did that kick off, if anything, of another creature sighting when it's really just Rico Browning trying to go to the bathroom in his Creature from the Black Lagoon outfit?
Wasn't there also in 1955 a case involving a woman who was swimming who claimed that there was something that grabbed onto her leg that felt like a hand or something like that? I
That might
remember,
be.
yeah, I remember, I do remember that case, which is like odd, odd timing, but I think that was 55, around that time. But like, yeah, that would be interesting if she did report that because if it's in the like local papers or something,
Or if it takes her a couple of years to report it because she doesn't want to talk about it because she thinks she's crazy. Like, does it show up and then her memory is kind of messed up because it's been a few years, so she doesn't really remember it the way that it was and really doesn't remember what he looked like because she took off before he, fully got out of the water. Like, he says that he chased her trying to tell her that he was an actor, but he said that her and the child were running too fast. So how often does shit like that happen too, where there are just fucking people fucking around, and then that gets turned into something else.
Also, like for a Hollywood set, a set and filming, they didn't really have that locked down very well.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you know anything about, you probably, I don't know, again, this is just a sidebar, but like when they were filming A Creature from the Black Lagoon, there's a lagoon in Jackson, near Jacksonville, that the owner never let anybody develop there. And so they would just go there and film. And it's the 50s, right? So, like, how many people are going off in the middle of nowhere to a lagoon? But obviously, this lady and a child had. And Rico Browning, this is a weird side conversation, but I just love it so much. Rico Browning was one of the very first people to do tube breathing. So he is the, as the creature, didn't have like an oxygen mask or pack. They just had a tube under the water hooked to an oxygen tank, and he would just breathe. He would put the tube in his mouth and breathe that way. So, like, literally, imagine the 1950s. You're there with like your mom or your aunt or somebody, and he would take a he could hold his breath for like 3.5 minutes. So, I
That's
mean, he gets.
insane.
He gets far away from where they're filming to get to this dock and just comes out of still, serene water. And this fucking creature comes out of the water. Someone had to have fucking reported that.
No, it's it that would be amazing if that's out there. Just like it'd be amazing if there was a sketch out there too of that. Oh God.
But where does fiction become reality? And people aren't good observers, too. That's the other thing.
So like when it comes to how things are recounted, like how much are witness sketches like just bad memory recall, and how much is it like just absolutely absurd alien beings just or whatever, just appearing to the, and I think another hallmark of what makes more of a believable kind of case is like and there's a great essay by Amy Michel in that Humanoids collection talking about non-contact. It's like they're not trying to make contact. They seem to be doing everything to prevent contact from happening, like paralyzing people, doing everything they can to just get away from them. So it's like aliens not really interested, just want to do what they want to do and then get the hell out of there,
And to like when I talked about too, like you talk about the witness sketches and that, like when I was would talk about still trying to figure out how to put this book together on what the Formanauts thing that I was still researching. Like the fact that the thing that does sell me on it is that the descriptions are different The little black triangle that someone described, a little black triangle with legs that had LED lights on its back, was described by someone else three blocks over as a black cat that had birthday candles on its back. And that actually sells me more on it because with no frame of reference, what are you seeing? Like it's not being described exactly the same. It's being described with this variation from witness to witness that has similar components, but is because their frame of reference is different than the other person's, they're describing it in a different way. And all of those weird creatures, whether it's the little black triangle or the big cube covered with hair or the legs with a robot top that someone saw in Kalamazoo, they're all just doing their shit. They're all just like walking down the street in someone's backyard, floating over the top of someone's house, floating through. They're just doing their shit. They're not trying to make contact with anyone. They're just doing things.
They're just there, kind of hanging out, checking the place out, doing what they want to do. And half the time they just ignore people. I think my favorite ones are when humans walk up, aliens are there. And they're talking amongst themselves. They look to be talking amongst themselves. And they see the humans show up and they're like, let's get out of here. And then they just get back in their UFO. It's like they don't even want to bother. Like, just you guys ruined the vibe. We're getting the hell out of here now. And like,
Well, even in when you listen to I just posted this in my Patreon. If when you listen to the description given by Ivan Sanderson of the Flatwoods Monster, which varies way differently than the depictions of it. Sanderson, who was there like 5 days after the event and talked to everybody and researched it, Sanderson describes the Flatwoods Monster as being in a silver suit that reflects the green of the ground. So it's not green, it's literally another silver suited creature, which is silver suits are, big with aliens too. And he also describes, the head and arms kind of being one piece, like a diving bell, and it having a round face plate. But they also describe it as like looking around, like it's looking for the other ones of it.
Dear God, no, that's creepy. I think it was one of the things that I appreciated. Like, I was a huge fan of Monster Quest back in the day, like, in the 2000s. I think they did a really good job of that episode because they showed you all of the different kind of iterations of what the Flatwoods Monster looked like. Because, yeah, there's one that just looks like it's half like a metallic bottom that looks like a trash can. The upper half is this like scaly looking, reptilian thing, and it's just like flying around. There's like flames coming from underneath it. Like they show you all the variations of that, and like I think that's what makes it more of an interesting case. Is like nobody really gets into that stuff. It's
Yeah, I
just
mean,
like.
Sanderson even says in his description of it when he was talking to the witnesses that he doesn't say that it had glowing eyes. He said that behind the reflective glass of the face were two dim blue lights like flashlights. And that's what was seemed to be turning and scanning in the direction, looking around, looking for its partners. So I mean that alone, like the fact that he's saying that witnesses are saying like there's lights behind glass. It goes from that, kind of eggy shape, big-eyed, now traditional Flatwoods monster to someone wearing like a diving bell.
Yeah, basically, like, which kind of makes you wonder, like, who's behind that? Who's out there in the kind of the middle of nowhere doing whatever they're doing? Is it aliens or is it, I don't know, some kind of weird military operation,
Well, and that the Flatwoods encounter has always been interesting to me because it doesn't get talked a lot about. So, like, and Sanderson does talk about this. He talks about the fact that he went out there and, in the course of interviewing Freddie May and all the Mays and all those people, He talks about how other meteors, bolides, crafts had landed in the area, and he goes to another spot where there's another landing, and him and Barker actually check it out because Gray is there now at the time too. So it's Gray, Barker, and Ivan Sanderson, and they go to another mountaintop where there's a huge ditch carved out where something has hit, and they find like a plasticine material there. And then if you look in the newspapers, you can go to newspapers.com and you can look up the day of the Flatwoods encounter, and there are meteors or comets or something all falling in a direct line down from the Flatwoods area, going all the way down to Georgia. Like there's five of them that like people see, like, what the fuck is that?
Yeah, there's more, it's just like a lot more to it that
Yeah.
yeah, it really makes you wonder like what the hell's
God, I
going on
love it
here.
so much.
And I will say that I will say this about 52 is a very weird year, not just because of like, the Washington merry-go-round shit or like the Sunny Diverger stuff or stuff like that. That's when these contactee stories start to emerge. That's
Oh,
when
yeah.
Bethrum has his encounter. That's when Adamski has his encounter. It's all of 1952. 52 is, I don't know, it's kind of like this like landmark year for everything. It's like, hey, they show up in 47. It's kind of quiet until 1952, where when everything just kind of, sets off and it becomes just this like very weird thing that gets only weirder over the years,
Yeah. I mean, I don't think that it really is, but I talk about like the cyclical nature of all of the high strangeness, whether it's ghosts, UFOs, Bigfoot, whatever. But it really does seem to me always to be like these weird repeating, and it doesn't always work, but there seems to be like a 5-year cycle. And it's interesting to me that the contactees kick off almost exactly 5 years after Kenneth Arnold's sighting. And like there is a big difference between like if you look at what starts to happen in like 57, like, and then you take it another 5 years and another 5 years, and it really does seem to be like, I don't know if it's because of people's memories or how long it takes to create a grift, like, but it really does seem to come in waves and in cycles.
No, definitely. And it's always interesting how, especially with flaps. I think the 54 flap is so fascinating because like it starts in Europe and then it moves to South America. Like it's such a very weird thing and it takes on a different, I mean, I think there are some similarities in some of the things that people were seeing in South America and like Brazil and stuff, but it's just like you get these weird creatures and these in the diving suits, and then you go to South America and there's short hairy beings that are assaulting people. And like that's the weird shit. It's not the other kind of bullshit that you read now. It's like it by design it does not make sense ever.
Right. And then, like I said, like I think whether it's the time it takes for people to rationalize or think about something, like there is, like again, I have to qualify and quantify this, not always, but you can take an incident and then you can jump about 5 years and then something turns. So, like, it doesn't necessarily even in a related field. Okay, so like the popularization big time of UFOs and aliens and high strangeness is X-Files, right? Like X-Files is released on in America, and fucking America explodes with fucking FBIs and UFOs and Mulder and Scully, right? So go 5 years before the X-Files and try and track. You know what's 5 years before the X-Files? Almost to the day is fucking Gulf Breeze. And you've got like UFOs, and you've got talk about the government, and pictures of flight. Like there's always this weird loop that happens. And again, I don't know if it's time to process information, the psychology of the human mind, or but it really does seem to come in cycles. At least for me, 5 year, it seems 5 year waves.
Yeah, no, that, and I mean, like, that's kind of, it's always the thing goes with like UFOs, is like it's always, mapped in flaps and waves and stuff like that. And I think, just in kind of some of the basic research that I was doing on other things, what I find interesting, especially about 1947, reading through Albert Rosales's stuff, there was like, I want to say at least 7 Marian apparitions that year, which is, it's interesting to tack on to like all of this UFO stuff that's being seen at the same time. And I mean, there, you do have early humanoid accounts. You have the Jose C. Higgins case that I'm pretty sure was published in 47.
Might have been, yeah.
Yeah, and then and I love Rapuzzi Johannes's story in Italy, just because, like, if you go and look up his art, his encounter definitely affected his art style. Because he did start to like do more like UFO art and stuff like that. So, like, it really makes you wonder, like, what did that man see? Did he see what, he's the OG little green man account encounter.
For sure.
That's the thing, man. It just makes you wonder. All this shit makes you wonder.
You know what? So real quickly, someone asked me when I was talking about 5-year cycles, someone asked me, well, what happened 5 years before 2017? Like there was no UFO stuff. And it's like, no, like it's not always related. It was fucking 2012. It was the fucking
All right.
end of the world. It was like major motion pictures about the end of the world, like the strangeness, like, and then 5 years later, now we're gonna release those fucking Tic Tac videos.
Now we're releasing Killjoy videos from the Pentagon that,
That's
that are
all
really
anyone's
dumb.
gonna talk about forever.
Like, I'm so sick of those
I'm
videos.
so sick of them.
Fuck.
That's why I appreciate the jellyfish video, you know?
I do. Like, yeah, I don't think it's a UFO, but it's a nice design. It kind of reminds me a little bit of that one Russian case from, what was it, the 70s or something like that? The jellyfish case where, like, they got a photograph of,
Oh,
yeah, I don't remember where the hell that took place in Russia, but the
No, but I mean,
photographs.
for a couple of days, you know, we had the jellyfish video and we had 10-foot tall aliens in Miami, and I was like, oh, okay, I'm okay with this strangeness. We're not talking about the government right now.
Yeah, I'm okay with the weirder bullshit. Just not the, I can do without the government hearings, although I really did get a kick out of that one in Mexico, just presenting alien bodies to your elected representatives. Just, I'm waiting for that day when that finally
I built my
happens.
own dry boy.
Did you?
I did. I wanted to see how hard it would be for me to make something that looked like what they had. And it took me a day. So I have my own little alien dry dusty salt boy. And if I do any conventions, I'm building a box for him. And I'm going to bring him around to conventions so people can see my recovered alien body, my non-human biologic.
Yeah, yeah. That stupid fucking term. Thanks, Rick Doty. Thanks for that fucking
Right.
bullshit. Oh God, like, it really is weird to see the arc that he's had. Like,
Crazy.
yeah, like, I ruined a man's life, but I pretend to have information.
And again, like it is so telling when we talked about earlier, like not knowing UFO history. It's so telling that these motherfuckers are still around. That shows you that no one understands. These experts nowadays, experts on UFOs, have no fucking clue what was going on in the 80s and 90s. The
Yeah.
fact that we're still dealing with Doty, the fact that we're still dealing with Lazar, like it's insane that this has come around again. Like, I really am waiting for a return to Billy Meyer.
Oh God, yeah. Like I'm surprised that we haven't got there yet. I need those photos of the tinfoil arms with laser guns, like just out in front of people again, because they're just
Amazing that those aliens only have one arm showing.
I know, it's so weird. It's so weird how they have that going, but like it kind of disappoints the hell out of me that the cyclical nature of this stuff is like the worst possible shit that it could be that comes back again and again and again. So like, I don't know.
If it's no fun, I'm not in.
Now, if those aliens aren't trying to, like, they don't look like a basically like a cartoonish looking ghost, and they're not trying to lure a child off of a roof, I don't want to hear about it, like
Right,
I
if they're not
want.
vacuuming up stuff and walking over walls.
Yeah, exactly. And if their UFO doesn't have like the flash symbol on it, I'm not interested. If I'm not seeing a red pair of legs running through a field
Yeah.
and an idiot driving away who decides to back up to get out of his car to ask the aliens if they're good or bad, I need this bullshit in my life. I need the new bullshit in my life. I need those cases to come back. But God damn it, John. We've been doing this for a while. You've got yourself a podcast. You've had it for a while now. What's up, weirdo? I think my favorite moments are when Jessica brings up a an alien body story and you lose your mind.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Jess has her feet in so many fires. I appreciate
Yeah.
because that's the other thing too is like Jess has a knowledge base, but it's not like my knowledge base. We have different lived experiences. And
Right.
so when she sees, video of a jellyfish or 10-foot tall aliens in the Miami Mall or stuff like that, like her brain melts for a second. But she has someone, luckily, she has someone that she can immediately text and be like, "What's this?" And I can say, "Junk." Like, you know what I mean? Like, don't worry about it. But sometimes she'll save stuff for the podcast and then be so excited to have not talked to me about it. And so
Yeah.
then I just lose my fucking mind because she's like, "But this guy said that there's alien bodies." And I'm like, "There's not, listen to his language. It's not at all what he said."
Yeah, no, and it never is. And like, I think one thing that people need to realize about crash saucers and recovered alien bodies is like those stories started emerging all at the same time. So that really makes you wonder. I mean, between Leonard Stringfield, who kind of made that his main thing for the last 20 years or so of its life, and Stanton Friedman, Bill Moore, all that stuff. It's like when you start to notice that all those
Start to
stories
come around at
have,
the same time. Yeah.
yeah, it's very telling that it's bullshit. I mean, you're gonna
Well,
tell
and
me that Stanton Friedman, just like doing a radio interview, and this guy just knows like Jesse Marcel. Okay, sure.
yeah. I mean, the other thing is too, and it doesn't get talked about a lot because you always hear about like the reverse engineering of alien technology that we got from their ships and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And this was not talking about saucers, it was talking about the advancement of humankind over the years. And yes, we make leaps in advancement and our technology advances and at a exponential rate and whatever, whatever.
No.
But years ago, I was talking to an engineer and he was talking about, if you took a television and showed it to someone in the 1400s, like, first of all, it wouldn't work because you don't have electricity. You just
Right.
have this box of electronics. And if they wanted to rebuild the television at that time would be, 400 or 500 years in advance of their technology, which means that they would have to create the technology. It would take as long to develop the system to create plastic components, press boards. It would take as long to develop the technology to recreate the technology as it would to just create the technology. So if you're recovering craft that are 10,000 5,000 years ahead of us technologically, you're not reverse engineering it in 5 years. You're not right. reverse engineering it in 10 years. You have to create components for things that you don't know what they are. Right. And they might be comprised of materials that you don't have access to. And so the fact that people are like, oh, you know, a UFO crashed and then a year later we had transistors, like we recovered it from the aliens. Well, then the aliens were only a year ahead of us.
Right.
And they already had interstellar travel.
Right. And I think the most telling thing, especially when you're talking about Lazar only worked on that thing for like 2 weeks. What did he honestly know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's like when people say, you know, and obviously my life and ideas have changed and evolved over the years. But like when people say, you know, you have to ask the president would know if there were UFOs, all the presidents are briefed on it and whatever like that. No, they're not. You would never brief a president on UFOs. At most, a president is going to be in a position of authority for 8 years. That's it.
Yeah.
Like you're not going to give a guy who could be gone in 8 years the knowledge of advanced extraterrestrial civilizations. Like the president who probably had the best chance of knowing if there were UFOs was George Herbert Walker Bush. And that's just because he was involved in the government through so many aspects of the government for so many decades that they were like, this guy's always going to fucking be here. And he kind of was.
Yeah.
But if you think that, like, as soon as you're sworn in as president, like that they took, you know, Trump or Obama or Biden, well, Biden, again, another lifelong governmental person who probably, you know, has been there, but someone who's only going to be there for 4 to 8 years and you're going to tell them all of the secrets, you're wrong.
Right. And like, you're telling me that this is the best that Harry Reid got? What's the ATIP program? Awesome.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah. That's it.
Yeah. Yeah. It just goes to show y'all, like, find the good stories. You got to find the really good stories, the baffling stories, the stories that make you scratch your head. You got to go find, you know, the pants running through fields. You got to go find the weird aliens that are making mooing sounds that you think maybe it hurt a cow and is trying to communicate with people. You know, go find the really weird shit, because that's where the fun is. That's truly where the fun is, because this, if you think this UFO shit that you're seeing now is fun, you know, aside from the jellyfish, which I will admit is fun to look at on a screen, you ain't seen nothing yet. You really haven't seen anything yet.
And yeah, find that. I can't remember what case is it that where they have the acorn headed aliens.
Oh God.
That's another Stringfield drawing where it's got like the big bulbous head that comes down into the tiny little acorn point.
Yeah. Yeah, that is another good one. Dear
Might
God.
Be walking with a cane or something like that, maybe.
Right. Oh, God. Yeah. I can picture it in my head right now.
This stuff, like, is supposed to be fun. It's supposed to engage us in conversations like this.
Yeah. Like, I need more, you know, images of Leonard Stringfield, you know, more sketches from Leonard Stringfield. I mean, we'll never get them again, but, like, you know, definitely the Bigfoot in the bubble. You know, just,
yeah,
that's what we need. That's always what we've needed. That's all we've ever needed.
Just need a little bit of fun.
Yeah, a little bit of fun. So yeah, John, thank you for coming on and just rambling with me for like an hour and a half.
I appreciate it. I love being able to talk to someone other than Jessica.
So you got What's Up Weirdo. What other stuff do you got going on right now? You know, you talk about zines and stuff, but what else is going on in John Tenney's world?
Yeah, I've got the zine will come out next month, the first issue. And then I'm finally, about 10 years ago, I interviewed a bunch of channelers who were all channeling aliens and put this book together, which is, it was tentatively titled Changing Channels, but I think now it's just going to be The Space People Speak Again. Mm-hmm. And when I interviewed all of them, I promised that I wouldn't publish it until they were all dead. And so last year, the last channeler died. And so that book will come out this year. And it's 10 different channelers channeling 10 different aliens from 10 different places. And it's super interesting. Like, I love channelers and I love the information they're getting. And the people that are in this book were specifically kind of chosen. I actually interviewed 20 and I pared it down to 10, just because listening to their stories, reading their stories, I find really fascinating. There's a little chart at the end where it gives each of their end of the world predictions, all of their like prophecies, and it lines up against each other to show you how they disagree with each other. And so that'll come out this year. And then what else? Oh, so back in 2010, I had my podcast Realm of the Weird, which was my like 13 weirdest stories. So I pulled all those down because I now have the technology to actually make them the way that I always wanted to have made them. And plus, I can clean up the audio, I can adjust levels, I can do all that stuff. So this year, Realm of the Weird returns in a new form. It's the stories are the exact same. They're not being rewritten or anything like that. They're just being recorded in a much better manner with much better like music in the background, more appropriate music. And there are three new episodes because in the time period, Realm of the Weird ended in 2013. In the 10 years since Realm of the Weird, there have been three more stories. So those three stories will be added. So Realm of the Weird, this Space People Speak Again, and the fanzine will come out this year. Plus, I'm getting my driver's license back, so I'm going to travel all over the country speaking at libraries.
Excellent. Yes, we're all waiting with bated breath about the license. You know, we've all been waiting.
It's coming.
It's coming. But like, folks, you got all of that great stuff to look out for. And thanks again, man. This has been great.
No, thank you.